Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, and here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan and the rest of the region this Thursday, March 13th, 2025. A former senior U.S. diplomat for Africa says fears over rising tensions in South Sudan are real as regional bodies work to defuse those tensions.
South Sudan continues to suffer under a political instability that has undermined its economy and its development goals and objectives.
And business owners in Western Equatoria State are not happy about the high taxes they're being forced to pay.
The tax rate was imposed on our traders by the previous head of state. It's not a normal tax.
These stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. With the recent deadly fighting in South Sudan, many observers worry that the country is slipping toward renewed conflict. About 10 days ago, a militia with ties to First Vice President Riek Machar captured an army base in Nasser, a major town along the border with Ethiopia. For his part, Machar has accused the South Sudan Army, under the leadership of President Salva Kiir, of recently carrying out attacks on his forces in nearby Ulaan County and attacking his supporters in other parts of the country. I asked Ambassador Johnny Carson, former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, if there's a real possibility that South Sudan could return to civil war.
South Sudan continues to suffer under a political instability that has undermined its economy and its development goals and objectives. The conflict that has been occurring in recent days does, in fact, threaten the very weak stability that has been in place since the end of the last five-year civil war between the forces of President Salva Kiir and his vice president, his first vice president, Dr. Riek Machar. Tensions appear to be extremely high as a result of the fighting that has been kicked off in large measure and exacerbated by the government's decision to arrest some senior officials who are aligned with First Vice President Riek Machar.
Given all that, what can the international community do, if anything, to head off such an occurrence where the things are amping up and it could maybe even get much worse?
The regional institution called IGAD, the Intergovernmental Organization in East and Central Eastern Africa and the Horn, has been meeting in emergency session under the leadership of the president of Djibouti, President Gali, and they have urged that there be an immediate end to the fighting that has occurred, and they have encouraged both parties to seek a political solution to their differences. I think IGAD has also dispatched a team to Juba in South Sudan to speak with both of the key leaders in this conflict with an end towards trying to de-escalate the current tensions and crisis. They've also asked that the government of Salva Kiir immediately release the individuals arrested unless they have actual evidence of criminal and illegalities. They think that the release of the associates of Dr. Riek Machar will reduce the level of tensions in the current situation.
But will these rising tensions have to be resolved, do you think, by regional organizations such as IGAD, like you mentioned, and or the African Union, or is it going to involve, do you think, the UN or other organizations?
First and foremost, I think it is the regional organizations. It's IGAD, which has taken the lead on trying to resolve the internal conflicts inside of South Sudan, joined by both the East African community and the leadership of the AU. the Peace and Security Council in the African Union. I think this remains a priority for the states in the region. They recognize that a return to major conflict in South Sudan will only worsen the prospects of economic and development progress in that country and contribute further to the humanitarian problems that currently exist.
You're familiar with this area, and you know how it is. When with the African Union, I mean, their track record in terms of trying to resolve these kinds of flare-ups and or like the military coups in the Sahel, they have their track record has not been that successful. So do you feel confident that, you know, the IGAD and African Union can do something here?
I think that the IGAD leadership recognizes the dangers that exist with the political and security instabilities in South Sudan, recognize how they can further contribute to the weaknesses in the region. I think they're committed. I think the president of Djibouti, President Gale, is committed to trying to de-escalate the situation. I do note, however, in a positive way, that the former Djiboutian foreign minister is now the chairperson of the African Union. Djibouti has a good track record of trying to mediate and resolve conflicts. I hope that they will continue to make this a priority as they appear to be doing so over the last week.
That is Ambassador Johnny Carson, former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. He was speaking with me earlier today here in Washington. South Sudan People's Defense Forces are giving hope to survivors of recent clashes in Nasser County. Several captives arrived at Juba International Airport today from Okobo County, escorted by the leader of the White Army in the area. Mamer Abraham Kwat reports for VOA from Juba.
Lul Roy Kong, the spokesperson of South Sudan People's Defense Forces, says plans are underway for all the SSPDF captives to be evacuated to Malakal soon.
Let me give hope to those who are in different locations in Wolang and Nasser that the operations to extract you from wherever you are has begun. And it had begun successfully in Bong Village. And this is the first successful extraction of our forces. The last one ended in failure and the killing of our general.
Lul advises captives not to oppose the community members who are taking care of them.
But don't go against the local population that have been protecting you. If they agree to escort you, we have what we call emergency mobile protection force we have put in place.
Solana Jeremiah Chua is the chairperson of the Upper Nile States Civil Society Network. He calls upon SPLM, SPLAIO to hand over SSPDF captives to the International Committee of Red Cross for safe evacuation.
We call upon the two sides in Nasser and also the side of SSPDF to exercise patience and allow these soldiers who were caught up in the fire and then for them to respect the international human rights law. Like when there is a captive or people who are caught, they have to be respected and then they are handed over to the Red Cross.
Pogbot Baluang, the acting press secretary in the office of the first vice president, Riek Machar, says they have identified more than 100 SSPDF captives in Wolang and surrounding villages. He says they are under the protection of SPLMIO forces in the area.
So far, we have listed 108 SSPDF officers. Currently, they have been hosted by the units and the locals in these areas. They have been taken care of and they are under protection of the SPLMIO forces.
Chui asked the SPLMIO and the White Army to respect the international humanitarian law, ensuring that the captives reach their families safely.
We need also to send a strong message to SPLMIO and then the White Army for them also to respect the international humanitarian law to make sure that these people are not harmed and they are taken to their families in a safer way.
The White Army spokesperson promised last week that the SSPDF soldiers would not be harmed by anyone. Onsen Chual James now says there is no clear agreement between the White Army and the government on the evacuation of captives. He warns that the lives of SSPDF soldiers will be at risk should a new deployment reach their area.
There is no any proper agreement For now, the government will lift these people with us. Yeah. Yesterday and today morning, when we heard that they sent another troop coming toward us, so we were shocked because the government is on the process to take these people from Wuhan then to Juba or elsewhere. So now they start another plan. And to be sincere with you, we cannot leave them like the way you guys think, because they may get killed anyhow.
Last week, a United Nations helicopter was attacked while attempting to evacuate SSPDF troops in Nasser. A UN pilot, an SSPDF general, and 22 troops died in that attack. For VOA News, I am Amer Abraham Kwod, reporting from Juba.
Many young girls fleeing the conflict in Sudan encountered difficulties on their journeys to other states across the country. 25-year-old Hibala Aldine Malith, who escaped from Khartoum with her mother and her three siblings to Port Sudan, says some men in uniform took away their valuables, including gold and money. Malith tells VOA's John Tanza that her journey from Khartoum to Port Sudan was grueling.
We came by bus from the place that we stay in to a place called Souk Sitta. There was buses there, and we took the bus to go to Al-Duwam in the White Nile. In the road, we caused of hard things. We saw
some hard things happen to you on the road. Yeah. Tell me what happened to you exactly.
First thing, Damseria. He was like stable in that place. When the bus was going to the White Nile, they stopped us, and then they was checking on our bags. They took money and they took gold. They took anything expensive.
They took anything that is expensive.
Yeah, they took anything expensive.
How did you know that these are rapid support forces?
We don't know. They was wearing their uniforms, so that means they're from them. After they take anything, there was a very beautiful girl in the bus. It was only with her mom. We was like 28 women and girls. There was no men except the driver. So they took that girl from her mom. Her mom was shouting and she cried, but they took the girl. And then they say to the driver, go. And if you didn't go, we will kill you and we will kill them all. So the driver, he drive and he took us to the White Nile. And we staying there, and her mom comes back. We don't know what happened after that.
And sorry about that experience. I know it's very hard. You see a lady being taken away from amongst
her
you.
Family.
Yeah, from her family. How did that experience affect you?
It was hard for me. Like, until now, sometimes I think, what if I was in her place? What if I didn't see my family again? If they took me from my mom, what's gonna happen for me and what's happened for her? Right now, it's like 1 year and 8 months. I don't know if her mom found her or no until now.
My understanding is you are a dual nationality, Sudanese and South Sudanese. Your father is from South Sudan. And your mother is here, but you were born here, grew up here. Yeah, someone would think, the first place you would think of escaping to is South Sudan. Why did you not go to South Sudan and opted to come to Port Sudan?
How am I going to go to South Sudan? The road, the money, the expensive buses to there. So it cost a lot. Specifically that we are four. If it was only me, maybe I will think to go there, but we are four. We don't can, like, handle the cost.
How do you feel being here in Port Sudan? How do you feel?
I thank God just because the place is safe. We just looking for a place safe. So Alhamdulillah.
This camp, I'm seeing only women and children. Why is that so?
There's no men here because the men stayed in their homes to save it or something. And our place, them say they didn't give the men chance to go out.
They did not give the chance for men to leave the house.
To leave the house, to leave the place. Like, they can leave the house to the market and go back, but they don't can travel out of the place.
That is Hibala Eldin Malith. She is a South Sudanese refugee sheltering at Abu Bakr Camp for the internally displaced persons in Port Sudan. She was speaking with my colleague John Tanza in the Red Sea state city of Port Sudan. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Some Western Equatoria business owners say they're being taxed way too much. Stay tuned. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Members of the Chamber of Commerce in Yambio, Western Equatoria State, have raised concerns over high taxes on traders and are urging the state government to reduce them. Business owners complain that the taxes are imposed by different offices and there appears to be no end in sight. Matea Samuel Timotio has this report for VOA from Yambio.
The acting chairperson of the Western Equatorial State Chamber of Commerce says traders are experiencing extreme taxation. Salah Anton says the state's high taxes have made it hard for traders to earn a profit, and it's gotten so bad that some shops in Yambio open market have closed.
The tax which was imposed on our traders by the previous head of state is not a normal tax. Because they can just pick any money they like it. What they have told us is this is the mandate of the government. Either you like it or you don't like it. They are going to increase the tax, but they did not mention what amount they are going to increase. And some shops are closed because of that high tax.
Salah says a truck owner has to pay thousands of dollars to enter South Sudan at the Nimle border crossing, and then once they reach Western Equatorial State, the driver will likely be forced to pay even more to the state government, prompting them in turn to increase the prices of goods at the market.
The impact is on the local citizen who cannot afford to buy a salt, a soap. When government imposes tax on us as a business people, we keep increase our price. Example, if I have a car, either I came with a full trucks, either I paid $3,000, $4,000 in the border, reaching to the state, they request more than the amount to be paid in the border. We are requesting the current acting governor to look to the matter. We are not refusing to pay tax, but we need a normal tax which we can afford.
Business owner says the tax rate is not fixed, so they are often charged multiple times. Salah says the receipts that they get when pay the fees just say sales tax. VOA tried repeatedly to get comment on the taxes from the National Revenue Office, the State Tax Division, and the Nimule Border Customs Office, but no one could comment. Dominic Keliona Guatayo is a trader in the Masia market in Yambio. He says his business is unable to grow because of the high taxes. He's appealing to the current leadership to lower the burden on people.
Since we started the business, we have taken long, but there is no improvement due to the high tax of the government. We have a lot of tax. In a day, you can receive a lot of tax. Those of security can come in the same day. In the same time, you will see those are saying that they are national tax. If the tax is too high like that, we'll never do anything to progress. We need to reduce that high tax that they bring to us.
Acting State Governor Daniel Badagurimbasa says the government will take a look at how taxes can be lowered.
We will have a Chamber of Commerce meeting. We will have the Minister of Commerce, people from Revenue Authority and from South Sudan Chamber of Commerce at the Business Union, so that we sit together, we see how we can support our traders. What can we do to empower them? What can we do also to make them enter into other crucial businesses, which they are not doing? Because I have visited the town in the market, but I will need to continue to see how we can arrange things.
Last year, the Network for Civil Society Organizations in Western Equatorial State said the multiple checkpoints along the Juba Ayambio Road led to skyrocketing prices for some goods in the state because drivers were charged fees at each checkpoint. For VOA News, I am Matia Samuel Timatio, reporting from the Western Equatoria State's capital, Yambio.
On the 49th anniversary of the proclamation of the Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic, Algeria's president reiterated to the head of the Polisario Front what Algeria calls its solidarity with the cause of the Sahrawi people and its steadfast support for its legitimate right to self-determination and independence in accordance with the charters of the United Nations and the African Union. Sarah Yerkes, senior fellow at the Carnegie Middle East Program, describes to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El Shnawi what that means after President Trump, in his first term, issued a proclamation recognizing Morocco's sovereignty over the Western Sahara.
I would say that Trump's proclamation, while it did represent a meaningful shift in the U.S. approach to Western Sahara, it didn't actually change anything on the ground. On the other hand, it did open the door for a lot of other countries to follow suit and to recognize Moroccan sovereignty over Western Sahara. But, you know, the UN is still the primary actor in the conflict. And during the past 4 years, the United States did continue to support UN leadership on this issue, despite President Trump's proclamation.
But in your recent study on the Western Sahara, you indicated that there are several ways the Trump administration may engage on the Western Sahara issue and move forward with the policy he put in place in 2020. Can you explain these options?
Sure. So I think that this is an issue that while not a lot of people are paying attention to it at the moment, it is an area where we saw Trump implement actual policy change. However, neither Trump or Biden did anything to implement this change over the past 4 years. But Biden also didn't do anything to reverse the decision. So Trump is sort of set up in a way with the ability to make some changes. One of those is that he could physically open up a consulate in Western Sahara, something he promised to do during the first term and didn't actually do. This isn't that likely right now, given the massive foreign aid cuts that we're seeing and the logistical security challenges with opening up a physical presence. But he could increase the U.S. presence more metaphorically. This could be through more high-level visits of U.S. officials or increasing U.S. economic investment, having the U.S.-Morocco Free Trade Agreement apply to Western Sahara, things like that. And then the third sort of bucket of things that the administration could do would be to work with Morocco and Israel to further implement the normalization agreement that was signed as part of the Abraham Accord.
In your study, you also mentioned that the United States-Algerian relationship, which is currently in a state of growth and expansion, will be tested should President Trump move forward with the implementation of the U.S. recognition of Moroccan sovereignty. Then what options does the administration have to maintain good relations with Algeria at the same time?
So I think one of the important pieces of data here is that Algeria does not see itself as party to the conflict. So I do think that there is room to continue to increase the bilateral relationship with Algeria through English language programs that are in very high demand, educational exchanges, other sorts of people-to-people engagement. But also, I think the Trump administration, for this to work, would need to reassure the Algerian government that the autonomy plan is the most realistic path forward at this point, given the position of all the other major actors, and it's in Algeria's interest to bring the conflict to an end. I think the Trump administration could also seek Algerian assistance in negotiating an autonomy deal that protects the human rights and the economic freedom of the Sahrawis to the greatest extent possible, trying to get the best deal possible for the Sahrawis in these more constrained circumstances.
But you said Algeria doesn't consider itself a party to the conflict. How would that impact the UN negotiations?
Algeria doesn't want to sit at the table and negotiate a deal. That's been one of the sort of prerequisites for the Moroccans, is they really want the Algerians there. They want the Algerians to take part in negotiations. Algeria doesn't want to do that. So I think what the Trump administration or what other important global powers, the European powers, could do is to work with Algeria separate outside of the formal negotiating process, to just help get the Sahrawis to the table, get the Sahrawis what they need, the support that they need behind the scenes in order to negotiate the best deal for them.
That's Sarah Yerkes, senior fellow at the Carnegie Middle East Program, speaking with my colleague, Mohamed El Shnawi. A Adamu Yemi Mobolade became the first Nigerian-American to be elected mayor of Colorado Springs in 2023. He tells VOA's Anthony Labruto that his immigrant experience informs his governance as the 42nd mayor of the western U.S. city and as the first black politician to hold this office in a predominantly white community.
I am a West African immigrant in a top, serving as mayor of a top 50 U.S. city. With the 39th largest city in the country.
Yemi Mobolade says he didn't choose Colorado Springs, but rather Colorado Springs chose him. After emigrating from his home country of Nigeria to the Midwestern state of Indiana, Mobolade continued his westward trek and landed in Colorado Springs, where he says he found his calling to pursue a career in politics.
Topophilia is a Greek word for love of place, and love makes you do stupid things like run for office, especially when you've never done it before.
Identifying as neither Republican or Democrat, the two major political parties in the United States, Mobolade draws his political philosophy from his experience as an immigrant and as an outsider to the systems many Americans have known their whole lives.
You're coming to the U.S. and you have your own formative experiences and your own culture and upbringing that you bring into the American context. So it's hard not to view the world with two different lenses.
According to a poll conducted yearly by Gallup, 56% of people in the United States identify themselves as either Democrat or Republican. 43% say they're politically independent, but that number often does not translate to political success for independent candidates like Mobolade. In the current 119th United States Congress, there are only two independent members out of 535. Working alongside a nine-member city council, Mobolade handles much of the legislative execution and administration of the city of Colorado Springs. The city is consistently ranked as one of the top places to live in the United States from a variety of U.S.-based news sources, attracting many people to live in the area. The consistent population growth, Mobolade says, is the strength of the city.
One of the Nigerian proverbs in the Yoruba language that I grew up hearing, and I can't say it in the Yoruba language, but I in English it says, the wisdom of others keep the king from being called a fool. I built different types of great teams and coalition, from advisory teams to a wonderful team of directors who I work with. So my job is to help cast a vision, provide the tools, get out of the way, and also be there to help as needed, to roll up my sleeve and to get in the grind to support. Another attribute of Abraham Lincoln is that he was a frontline leader. He wasn't a leader, just sat in his ivory tower. But I'd say that the city has five main priorities, and this should not be a support.
Citing community engagement as one of his top priorities, Yemi Mobolade says he keeps the city at the center of every decision he makes. But in a place where only 5% of the city's population is black, finding visible connection and support from other African immigrants has been difficult compared to other established diaspora hubs in the United States.
We know what it's like to not have. We know what it's like to lack. We know what it's like to be in a land of opportunities and to go after it and to chase it. And it's, I believe some of that is the story of this great country that we're losing. And I know the story of immigration right now is can be very political and controversial. These are the stories we need to champion and celebrate. This is what it means to be a nation of immigrants. The sky truly is the limit. You can accomplish anything you set your mind to, and you have what it takes. And your cities and this country needs what you have and what you can bring to the table. So go for it.
Anthony Labruto, VOA News, Washington.
And that wraps it up for us this Thursday. We invite you to check out voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. If you somehow missed this broadcast, just head on over to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. VOA Africa is now available on WhatsApp to share your input on our broadcast, including listener comments, or receive our daily news updates. Just text us on +1 202-322-7510. You can also follow our WhatsApp channel by searching for us and our username, VOA Africa. We now leave you with the song Calm Down by Rima featuring Selena Gomez. I'm your host, Carol Van Dam in Washington. On behalf of our engineer, Bob Bass, producer, Kwame Afori, thanks for tuning in. We'll talk again tomorrow evening on another edition of South Sudan in Focus from The Voice of America.